Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud, the podcast where a few of our favourite writers from each week's issue read out their pieces for you. Douglas Murray kicks off this week's episode with his column on the problem in America, or one of them, is how people see the same events but disagree on what they have just seen. Then we'll hear from Lara Prendergast, who takes us inside the court of Carrie Simmons. And at the very end, Andrew Wilson, on his article which you might not expect to find in a Spectator, in support of Scottish independence. First, Douglas Murray.
Ever since I saw him in Pensacola, Florida, the other week, Donald J. Trump will not leave me alone. Each morning, I wake up, turn on my phone, and find more messages sent overnight. On just one morning this week, I rolled over to find emails from him titled "Chaos, Rigged, and We're Gaining Momentum." Another said, "The left hates you, Douglas." He doesn't know the half of it. Clearly, my email address has been shared, because in just one morning, I also got emails from Mike Pence, "We're closer than ever," Eric Trump, and bewilderingly, for I cannot see what fresh constituency she brings, Eric's wife, Lara. Perhaps I shouldn't have handed over my details when signing up for the Pensacola rally. I feel like one of those early users of the internet who actually responded to the Nigerian emailers offering part ownership in a diamond mine. Anyhow, even if you don't receive his emails, you might have guessed by the desperation that Trump has lost the election. "Let's finish this thing," is one of this morning's emails. Yet it seems to me that the thing is finished already, with America now having to pull off the most difficult imaginable set of juggling tricks. The first thing to juggle is the fact that there is plenty of evidence of electoral fraud. In the US, as in the UK, witness Tower Hamlets, the public are right to fear that mail-in ballots in particular are a positive invitation to electoral malpractice. Of course, right now, no Democrat in America will concede that there is or ever has been any fraud in the US electoral system. The fact that these same people spent the past 4 years claiming that the Russians rigged the 2016 election while never providing any proof for their claim makes this an especially tricky juggle. After 4 years of undermining the US electoral system, they must now insist that it is so watertight that no ballot could ever be incorrectly accounted for. I suspect they will manage it, with the level of integrity one has come to expect from the current leadership of the Democratic Party. Still, the trick that Trump and his team must pull off is the harder one, because it is more urgent. They must show that the corruption in the US voting system is so vast and consistent that rather than a few counties potentially flipping on appeal, whole states currently called for Joe Biden will reverse and go to Trump, who, as a result, will retain the presidency. They have not so far produced such evidence, and as the days drag on, it seems likely that they do not have it. Over the past fortnight, I'd have said that the possibility of the election outcome reversing has gone from a just about double-digit percentage chance to a post-decimal point one. The president's loyalists assure me that what they have is good, that it is going to go all the way, that the Supreme Court may get involved and that this body will rule in the president's favour. I think this has become a pipe dream, and forgets, though this shouldn't necessarily be a factor, that were it to happen, the radical left would burn America to the ground. Yet, underneath all these disagreements, a larger problem can be discerned. I suspect that after spreading enough of the rigged narrative around, Trump will eventually be persuaded to leave office with the kind of grace and good nature that we have also come to expect from him. He will have his own narrative to draw on, just as the Democrats will have theirs. He knows what wells he can draw on. Presently, more than 8 out of 10 Americans who voted for Trump believe that this election was rigged and that Biden is not the legitimate president. There are people who will deprecate that fact, but if they do, then they should also deprecate all those Hillary Clinton voters, including Clinton herself, who spent 4 years refusing to accept the result of the last presidential election. Although, to be fair to her, at least Clinton did not attempt to break in and then blockade herself into the Oval Office. The cop-out at this stage is for people to lament the divided media in America and blame them for this pass. And it is true that the US media is partisan in a way that would shock viewers of the current Sky UK. In fact, American media simply has a bias balance. Complaints about it tend to presume that if media bias is going to go in any direction, it should always and only be leftwards. Fox News is forever trotted out and blamed for exacerbating partisanship in US politics. But such critics are, among other things, wildly out of date. Many Trump voters now loathe Fox News, blame it for calling Arizona for Biden early, and otherwise view it as some kind of left-wing sellout. Into which gap a post-presidency Trump will likely enter with Trump TV. But all this misses the deeper point. As millions of rows in millions of homes over recent months can attest, the trouble in America is not that people absorb different information streams. The problem is that they now see the same events, but disagree on what they have just seen. The trend has been growing for years and is not confined to America. It is a byproduct of the information age. 2 years ago, the Chancellor of Germany and the head of the country's BFV domestic intelligence service disagreed publicly on what a video leaked from an anonymous Twitter account showed. The disagreement led to the departure of the BFV leader, and up until then, it was probably the highest level example of a disagreement over the nature of what two people had seen with their own eyes. The 2020 US presidential election is this on a far bigger, even more catastrophic scale. There are ways to fix this, not least by trying to agree on one thing and then going from there. For example, the incoming administration could set up a cross-party or non-partisan review into voter fraud, seeking to get to the bottom of exactly what the vulnerabilities in the system might be. Agreeing on election results would be a good place for any healing to start. But I don't expect them to do this. The Democrats want peace and reconciliation on their own terms. The Republicans will pay the Democrats back by starting an investigation and attempting to impeach Biden. Disagreements on policy are nothing compared to an inability to agree on what you have just seen. And America cannot agree on what it has just seen. Expect American unreality to enter a whole new orbit.
That was Douglas Murray. And now, Laura Prendergast.
Carrie Simmons, the Prime Minister's fiancée, gets the media. That's what her friends are quick to tell you. She's a PR professional. If she doesn't like the thrust of a story, she lets you know. She contacts journalists to tell them how disappointed she is in their sloppy work. And she doesn't seem all that scared of senior newspaper editors, perhaps because her father co-founded The Independent. It's said she even thinks she can edit what goes in the mail on Sunday. When the Times ran a silly piece suggesting she had grown weary of Dylan, her rescue dog, and that the poor creature was facing a reshuffle, she is said to have interrupted a Cobra meeting to ask Boris to help her respond to the allegations. Never mind the pandemic, Carrie's cutesy image was at stake. The dog isn't that popular in Number 10, confessed one source, but nobody wants to tell Carrie this. Last week, we saw how Carrie controls the narrative. Even her detractors must admit it was quite formidable. She has purged Number 10 of Dominic Cummings, another person who also likes to control the national conversation, and Lee Kane, the Prime Minister's communications chief. The Vote Leave boys took a hiding. Or, as one breathless admirer put it, she took on their press machine and won. She outwitted the Vote Leave tribe. For some MPs, this makes her their new patron saint. For others, it shows how Machiavellian she really is. Part of the reason she was able to conquer the Brexit lads was because she has assembled her own impressive court, which works hard to counteract negative stories about her. She has loyal friends in convenient places. Her former squeeze, Harry Cole, is now political editor at The Sun. Politico journalist Alex Wickham is a godparent to her son Wilfred. Are you thinking that it is a bit unusual for the 32-year-old, unelected, not yet third wife of the Prime Minister to be calling the shots? Don't. That's sexist and you should know better. Carrie's admirers are quick to scold those who dare suggest that she might be getting a bit big for her green wellies. Do you really not expect a Prime Minister to consult with his partner in the 21st century? Enough with the Lady Macbeth comparisons, such a cliché. Carrie's orchestration of the latest regime change has been presented, by Team Carrie, as a feminist triumph. We were told, via the Mail on Sunday, that Carrie ensured Allegra Stratton, the new Downing Street press secretary, would be paid as much as Kane and Cummings. That's girl power, all right, but the suggestion that Carrie is a great champion of women has also surprised some Westminster types. She's not really a fan of other women, says one person who has worked with her. Perhaps that's because Boris is. Carrie and Boris's family has grown. Dylan arrived last year and Wilfred was born in April. Boris and Carrie are due to marry at some point, although the Prime Minister is said to think she deserves a big wedding, which isn't possible while his 15-person limit on special occasions remains in place. Dog, ring, baby. Carrie has reached many of the milestones which millennials like to brag about on their Instagram accounts. Boris even hosted a baby shower for her at Chequers. But the events of the past week suggest that she's after much more. Her interest in Boris goes beyond the personal. It's political. So what does Carrie want? She is keen to present herself as a green, animal-loving Tory, the Princess of Wales. The causes close to her heart are conspicuously cuddly. She has taken a bold stand against trophy hunting for puffins in Iceland, for example. But her brand of greenery is a far cry from any conservative notion of curating the countryside. She's spoken at events with Chris Packham, who opposes hunting and pheasant shooting. She is the driving force behind many of Boris's green recovery policies and thinks it is brilliant that the government plans to return 30% of the UK to the wild by 2030. It remains to be seen how popular all this is with Tory voters, let alone Boris's increasingly bewildered supporters in the north. Carrie is a millennial conservative. What matters to her is that she is seen to be alert to injustices in society. She has best pals with Nimka Ali, co-founder of the Daughters of Eve project, which campaigns against female genital mutilation. Ali has been awarded an OBE and made an independent advisor to the government. She is also reported to be another of Wilfred's godparents. Ali has repaid these honours by calling Boris a true feminist. Earlier this year, the PM played a cameo role in an LGBT plus lip sync battle held over Zoom, which Carrie was judging. We can probably expect a lot more of these sorts of PR stunts now that Carrie has binned the toxic males. Boris is self-isolating for 2 weeks, making Carrie the only advisor with walk-in access to the Prime Minister, and it's likely she has strong views on the cabinet reshuffle, the appointment of his new Chief of Staff, perhaps even the future direction of MI5. What Carrie wants is for her people to be in power. Boris is said to have been uneasy with her parallel press operation, but he's even more anxious about Carrie not getting what she wants. She tends to get what she wants. The question is, how long can that last? Controlling the narrative is one thing. Controlling the government is quite another.
That was Lara Prendergast. And finally, Andrew Wilson.
Tony Blair's biggest achievement was delivering a referendum that unified Scotland behind devolution and gave all parties a stake in its success. Boris Johnson is wrong to say it was a disaster, but in being wrong is helping precipitate the logical next step, independence. the opinion polls show that a growing majority for Scottish independence. This will mystify those who believe the lazy metropolitan idea that independence is an emotional fantasy, all Braveheart, Bannockburn and bagpipes. How, they ask, could a band of Caledonian romantics ever convince the canny Scots to opt for such a thing? But what if the case for independence was a highly sophisticated position advocated by one of the most popular political leaders in the world? It's now supported by 64% of those aged under 65, according to one of the latest polls. The Spectator, while founded by a Scot, has never supported the idea of his own land's independence. But its readers rightly pride themselves on reading different points of view. I seek not your support, so much as your understanding as I try here to explain what's really going on. The problem for Scotland is that it cannot afford to stay on the UK's glide path. Staying in the Union is riskier than independence. Voters can see that. So why now? Brexit is the biggest part of the answer, not just the fact of it, but the manner of it. Brexit has become the emblem of a parting of perspective, outlook, ambition and values. Scottish voters want Scotland to return to Europe. It is true that Boris Johnson and his unpopularity in Scotland doesn't help the Unionists' case. But Scottish voters aren't stupid and won't make a permanent decision just to escape a Prime Minister whose premiership is as deciduous as autumn leaves. The issue is not so much him as the system that created him, and when he goes, as he will, that will remain. Independence support is also emphatically not born of a chip on the shoulder towards England. If you don't believe me, ponder this. In the 2014 referendum, a majority of people born in Scotland voted for independence. The no vote was secured by the votes of people born elsewhere. Supporters of independence do not make anything of this because they know that where people were born doesn't matter. Scots look at Britain and see a country whose standing in the world is at its lowest ever ebb. They see Brexit as a regrettable desire to retreat from that world. Every society now looks into the future asking what to do after the pandemic ends. Which parliament would Scots choose to lead them through the great reform era that is upon us? Holyrood or Westminster? Which do you think they trust more? On policies, on climate, crisis, inequality and public finances? Who do you think? In his outstanding book The Levelling, What's Next After Globalisation, the Irish author Michael O'Sullivan points out that in 1924, Argentina was three times wealthier than Japan, but is today half as rich. His point is that countries can make colossal strategic errors. The UK has been in slow descent for some time now. It used to be the richest country on earth, but currently sits in 21st position in the IMF rankings, and Brexit is hastening the drop. Why should Scotland now buckle in and to continue to not enjoy the ride? Unionists have long stopped arguing a positive case. Instead, they say a different future for Scotland cannot be sought because of the starting point and the difficulties of the transition. Deficits, currency, borders, it all adds up to the same argument. I wouldn't start from here. So Scotland is stuck. This is a thin and vision-free case. The SNP prospectus is worked out and clear on currency, public finances and how it would approach an agreement with the rest of the UK. It seeks an orderly transition that is stated in advance, the antithesis of Brexit. Scotland would retain sterling until preparation for a new currency are complete and tests are met ensuring that it is in Scotland's interests. That will take time. Rome wasn't built in a day, but it was worth building. A new central bank would be created immediately, serving similar functions to Euro-member central banks until the currency timing is right. The UK economy is one of the most unequal in the developed world. Every region outside the South East has large notional but estimated deficits, and Scotland's is by no means the worst. The economic inequality that underpins them is the very reason to change, not to shore up the status quo. Levelling up? No, the Scots have higher ambition. The UK deficit this year after COVID will be more than twice what Scotland's was last year, proportionally, and it is being funded at historically low rates of interest. And yet Scots are asked to believe that with their deficit starting point would be unfundable. Clearly, this is not true. Furthermore, the Scottish Government will seek to agree an annual solidarity payment to the UK Government to make good the agreed share of inherited debt interest payments and any joint work and projects that continue. How do you think that policy compares with the UK approach to Brexit? Which brings me to the border. Scotland wants a frictionless one, yet Brexit imposes a new one to our east and to our west. We still, 4 years after the Brexit vote, await the detail and what it will mean. What is so wrong, then, with the Scots, an identity of choice, not birth? wanting to have their own choices determine who they are. They know it will take a huge effort, it will be hard work, but a growing majority believe it will be worth it.
That was Andrew Wilson. Thanks for listening and join us again next week.